times you are about to hear are true. MC's names have been changed to protect the innocent. The innocent.
Somebody tell him who I am. Buck 10 can. the neck, pull the egg in your shoe and beat it. Be a tree stand where you are when you get out. And if anybody runs, your boots, I'll cook them.
Gave a smile to his boys and then said,
book them, book them, book them, book them, book them.
Peace, peace, peace. There'll be a tree standing there when you get out. Some time, boy. Good morning, everybody. I know I was late getting on this morning, but I'm on. So I'm going to make this quick. I ain't got time to do a lot of like pre-show type stuff and everything. So I'm going to get right to it. Today I wanted to talk about some indictments this morning. Been getting a lot of phone calls about indictments. I wanted to run through some information real quick on indictments. And first, I'm going to direct people to go to my website at highfrequencyradionetwork.com. And I want you to get a document called Abatement of Common Law. It's under the constitutional section. It has a whole section on right to travel, but unbeknownst to many of y'all, it has a whole section on how to abate a federal indictment. Very good information. Some of the best information I've seen in a while. So I'm going to go into this on about this indictments real quick. Okay, indictments. We're talking about federal indictments. Now, the funny thing about federal indictments, I don't know if anybody knows that it, essentially what happens is when you get a federal indictment, when the feds come and get you, they already have an indictment ready for you. You've already been indicted. They show up at the front door, knock at the door. You know, they might have the ATF with them, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, they looked into your information and saw you went to a gun show and bought a, you know, a pistol grip pump or something like that. So they're going to show up at your house, you know, with about, you know, 30 agents all armed and everything. You know, it's like, damn, you know. But this is how they get down, you know. So we're going to talk about this morning. We're going to talk about grand juries and federal indictments this morning, okay? And there is a and if you get into the abatement of common law document, it starts on page 58. Page 58. And it says, defendant notice to abate a memorandum of law and support. And this is real good. And I'm going to run through this thing. It starts on page 58. And the caption of the pleading, it's in, it is a federal, it's federal pleading in the United States District Court of, it could be like here in Atlanta, it would be the Northern District of Georgia, Atlanta Division, or whatever. And then, of course, it's going to have the United States, the legal fiction United States Corporation versus whoever is your straw man. And that's going to be, you know, in the caption of the pleading. Let me put this in the, I don't know if people, it's on my website, y'all, but I'm going to read this to you. Now, the first paragraph of this is a section that a lot of people use to start off a lot of their pleadings and everything, because it makes reference to Haynes versus Kinner, that courts need to construe pro se litigants' pleadings liberally, which they never do. They don't ever follow that rule. But defendant Yusufel files this notice to abate plaintiff's suit for lack of subject matter jurisdiction as authorized by Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 12b1. Defendant asks this court to take judicial notice of the fact that he appears without assistance of counsel, is not schooled in the law and legal procedures, and is not licensed to practice law. Therefore, his pleadings must be read and construed liberally. See Haynes versus Kerner and also Burrow versus Estelle. Further, defendant believes that this court has a responsibility and legal duty to protect any and all of the accused constitutionally and statutory rights. And this is true, all right? The judges are supposed to sui sponte, take notice whether or not your constitutional protected rights are being violated or not, but they don't ever do that. So let's look at the introduction. The United States of America is the plaintiff. Usavail is the defendant. Plaintiff sued defendant for, state the basis of the suit. Okay, whether it is, you know, fraud, you got some dope possession, distribution of cocaine, whatever. The court lacks subject matter jurisdiction over the plaintiff's suit, therefore the suit should be abated. And here's the argument. The court's jurisdiction is restricted to cases wherein there has been no deprivation of constitutional rights of the parties. Now, that first sentence is key in jurisdictional issues, okay? That is the only way that you can appeal something or, you know, take something to the Supreme Court or do constitutional challenges, okay? You have to be able to demonstrate whether or not they violated a constitutional right. Now, let me give you some more information. On my website, I have another book, and they do not like this book, but they actually tried to charge me with this book. I got arrested one time, and I had this book in my possession. But the name of the book is called The Outlaw's Bible. It's called The Outlaw's Bible. It is on my website as well. It's called The Outlaw's Bible. And I think I got it under the constitutional section. Yeah, it's under the constitutional section. Go to my PDF section, go into where it says Constitution and State Laws, and you will see a book called The Outlaw's Bible. And what this book basically tells you to do is how to conduct yourself so if they arrest you, they'll violate one of your constitutional rights. All right? It's called The Outlaw's Bible, okay? Matter of fact, they arrested me and they had this book on me. It was showing it to the judge. Look at what he has, judge. A lot of y'all don't even know about this book. Well, y'all listen to high frequency radio and just find out all kind of, you know, like good information. But it's called The Outlaw's Bible. Very handy book to have on your person if you are trying to maintain privacy or if you're out there hustling or doing something like that, you know. Check out The Outlaw's Bible because, you know, you may need to, you know, use some stuff in there one time or another. But anyway, it's called The Outlaw's Bible. Outlaw's Bible is the name of the book. And I'm pulling it up right now. And you'll see in this Outlaw's Bible, it'll have some how to evade the system using constitutional strategy. It's called The Outlaw's Bible, How to Evade the System Using Constitutional Strategies, put out by Lupanix, too. I think Lupanix went out of business, but I have a link to some other sites in my link section. This book is dedicated to the cops who should not be referred to herein as pigs out of respect for their species of animals. Okay. Every now and then, the forces of time, circumstance, and fate together and certain lives and happenings, well, I'm not going to read all this, but anyway, this is what it is. It talks about introduction, cops, courts, keepers, the Constitution, warrant requirements, the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure of the person, places of privacy, breaching the castle gate, belongings, privacy of words, Miranda and seizure of words, the squeeze, dirty tricks, the airport, the Ten Commandments, all of this stuff. Part one, okay? And so, you know, you go, and this is a pretty good book, you know, for a person to get some foundational understanding of the stuff. When a person cannot know how a court will apply a settled principle to a recurring factual situation, that person cannot know the scope of his constitutional protection, nor can a policeman know the scope of his authority. And it starts out with a citation of authority coming from Justice Potter Stewart in New York versus Belton. And this is a good book, you know, for people to read. It is an enjoyable read, and it's an easy read. So, you know, just read, that's just something out there for some people. I put in there that kind of like as a little bonus and everything. Y'all go to my website, highfrequencyradionetwork.com. It's called The Outlaw's Bible. So back to the abatement. It says the court's jurisdiction is restricted to cases wherein there's been no deprivation of constitutional rights of the parties. The plaintiff has deprived the defendant of his due process rights. The administrative agency has proceeded without statutory and regulatory authority, and the administrative agency has deprived the defendant of substantive due process rights. The court is deprived of subject matter jurisdiction. Now, any time that there is a procedural error on the part of these administrative agencies, then there is a violation of due process, and it's a constitutional question that's going to be brought in. These administrative agencies, all they have to do is follow the procedures correctly, and they're going to win. They're going to win every time. If they follow the procedures correctly, they're going to win. So if you're going to beat them statutorily, you have to attack the procedures that they're using. One of the procedures that they violate almost everybody is showing up at your house already with an indictment in hand. Almost every time it's going to be a violation of due process rights, and we're going to see it right here. It says due process requirements relating to grand jury arrays and indictment. Now, defendant now summarizes indispensable or substantive elements of federal criminal prosecution, which constitutes applicable due process rights in the instant matter, which were not afforded the defendant. A, the criminal prosecution process may commence if and only if there is an affidavit of criminal complaint submitted under oath and a probable cause hearing, Rule 3, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. And they almost always don't do that either. They give you some flimsy affidavit that's coming from some investigator or something like that. There's an injury or something, and never is. B, a committing magistrate must issue a warrant or a summons after finding probable cause, as Rule 4, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. And C, the defendant may be arrested and returned by the appropriate federal authority, Rule 4, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. D, the defendant has an initial appearance at which he is asked to enter a plea and bond, if any, is set. If the offense is a felony offense, a United States magistrate judge may not ask for or enter a plea. The defendant is entitled to a preliminary hearing unless an indictment or information against a corporation is returned prior to the preliminary hearing. Now, I want y'all to understand that informations are going against corporations, and sometimes they bring, in some states, informations against people. That should let you know that your straw man is a corporation. They're bringing information against you. They, in Georgia, they use all three. They use indictments, accusations, and informations. And they put that in the Constitution here in Georgia as well. But it goes on, it says, in the event that the defendant is joined by a grand jury under Rule 8 and has not previously been arrested, the federal criminal prosecution process begins here, and the defendant is entitled to a preliminary hearing. See Rule 5, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. If the defendant exercises his right to a preliminary hearing, he has the opportunity to cross-examine adverse witnesses, and he may introduce his own evidence, whether the evidence is via a witness or is documentary evidence. And that's Rule 5.1, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. The preliminary examination may be bypassed only in the event that the defendant waives the right or indictment issues subsequent to the initial appearance. In the federal system, corporations may be prosecuted by information. F, the defendant or his counsel has the right to challenge the array of the grand jury pool and voir dire individual grand jury candidates prior to the grand jury being sworn in. Rule 6B, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, and 28 U.S.C. 1867. Now, let's look at this right here. Because this is old, and I want to make sure they ain't changed it around, because they was changing things around because people were finding, you know, when we find out information, they have to change it around. Challenging compliance with selection procedures. And Rule 6, the grand jury. I'm going to put this up on my website. Challenging compliance with selection procedures. In criminal cases, before the voir dire examination begins, or within 7 days after the defendant discovered or could have discovered by the exercise of diligence, the grounds therefore, whichever is earlier, the defendant may move to dismiss the indictment or stay the proceeding against him on the ground of substantial failure to comply with the provisions of this title in selecting the grand or petit jury. In criminal cases, before the voir dire examination begins, or within 7 days after the Attorney General of the United States discovered or could have discovered by the exercise of diligence, the grounds thereof, whichever is earlier, the Attorney General may move to dismiss the indictment or stay the proceedings on the ground of substantial failure to comply with the provisions of this title in selecting the grand or petit jury. In civil cases, before the voir dire examination begins or within 7 days after the party discovered or could have discovered by the exercise of diligence, the grounds therefore, whichever is earlier, any party may move to stay the proceedings on the ground of substantial failure to comply with the provisions of this title and selecting the petit jury. Upon motion filed under Section A and B or C of this section containing a sworn statement of the facts which, if true, would constitute a substantial failure to comply with the provisions of this title, the moving party may be entitled to present in support of such motion the testimony of the jury commission or clerk, if available, any relevant records and papers not public or otherwise available used by the jury, commissioner, or clerk, any other relevant evidence. If the court determines that there has been a substantial failure to comply with the provisions of this title in selecting the grand jury, the court shall stay the proceeding pending the selection of a grand jury in conformity with the title or dismiss the indictment, whichever is appropriate. Okay, if the court determines that there has been a substantial failure to comply with the provisions of this title in selecting the petit jury, the court shall stay the proceedings pending the selection of the petit jury in conformity with this title. The procedures prescribed by this section shall be exclusive means by which a person accused of a federal crime, the Attorney General of the United States, or a party in a civil case may challenge any jury on the ground that such jury was not selected in conformity with the provisions of this title. Nothing in this section shall preclude any person or the United States from pursuing any other remedy, civil or criminal, which may be available for the vindication or enforcement of any law, prohibition, discrimination on account of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, or economic status, and the selection of persons for service of grand jury or petit juries. Now, let's go back to six. Let me save this. And this is something I'm giving this out because I'm getting a lot of people contacting me about, indictments and things of that nature. So I want y'all to understand that you got to know, y'all got to know as soon as they come to you with something like this. Now we go to Rule 6, the grand jury challenge. Objection to the grand jury and grand jurors. That's 6B. It says challenges the attorney for the government. The attorney for the government or defendant who has been held to answer in the district court may challenge the array of jurors on the ground that the grand jury was not selected, drawn, or summoned in accordance with law, and may challenge an individual juror on the ground that the juror is not legally qualified. Challenges shall be made before the administration of the oath to the jurors and shall be tried by the court. Motion to dismiss. A motion to dismiss the indictment may be based on objections on the array or the lack of legal qualifications of an individual juror, if not previously determined upon challenge. It shall be made in the manner prescribed in 28 U.S.C. subsection 1867E and shall be granted under the conditions prescribed in that statute. An indictment should not be dismissed on the ground that one or more members of the grand jury were not legally qualified if it appears from the record pursuant to subdivision C of the rule that 12 or more jurors, after deciding the number not legally qualified, concurred in the findings of the indictment. Four person and deputy four persons. The court shall appoint one or more. And here's another thing. The indictments have to be signed. Okay? Sealed indictments. Now, there's a difference in sealed indictments. Somebody just sent me something this weekend, and it's an indictment, and stamped on the front of it is under seal. Under seal and sealed indictments are not the same thing. The only thing where place you're going to find under seal in a Black's Law dictionary is when it's talking about deeds. A sealed indictment and something filed under seal are not the same thing. Now, sealed indictments, the federal magistrate judge to whom an indictment is returned may direct that the indictment be kept secret until the defendant is in custody or has been released pending trial. Thereupon, the clerk shall seal the indictment, where no person shall disclose the return of the indictment except when necessary for the issuance and execution of a warrant or summons. And then we're going to talk about that a little bit today, all right? Because that's what they mostly do with most people. They indict you. And then they come and get you. And that is going to be the basis of what we're going to be talking about today with these indictments and everything, these federal indictments, because they have to be addressed because they just running us through the federal system like it's like, you know, nobody is challenging anything. They so lackadaisical with it that it's just, you know, they just arrest you at will and charge you with anything and you can't fight it. But it goes on. Let's go to F. I'm back on abatement of common law. If you're just joining us on page 60, and we're talking about indictments, abating grand, federal indictments. And it goes on, it says, the defendant or his counsel has the right to challenge the array of the grand jury pool and voir dire individual grand jury candidates prior to the grand jury being sworn in. Now, voir dire which is spelled V-O-I-R, and dire, D-I-R-E, means, it's a Latin word that means to speak the truth. It's when you're questioning the grand jurors and trying to see whether or not, you know, they are, you know, capable of being grand jurors. But the, it means to speak the truth, vor dire. Okay? Now, it goes on, it says, in the course of the investigation based on an affidavit of complaint and the finding of probable cause, a grand jury may, by presentment, issue additional indictments and or join additional defendants in compliance with the provisions of Rule 8, Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Now, here it is, this word presentment. This word presentment is a very deceptive term because it has two different meanings. It has a common law meaning and it has a commercial meaning. And the commercial meaning, it is a bill of exchange. It is a negotiable instrument. And we know that you are in a commercial court. So when you read the Constitution, it says nobody shall be, you know, charged with anything except on presentment of a grand jury. We see that in the Sixth Amendment. Okay. But that's common law. They use that same word. I didn't trick everybody. They use the word presentment. But presentment also means, when you look at the other senses of the word, it has a commercial meaning. It's a negotiable instrument. So when they hit you with an indictment, it is a presentment. It is a negotiable instrument. How do you know it's a negotiable instrument? Because you need to know the nature and cause of the action. If we are in a commercial court, which these territorial courts are, they're Article I legislative tribunals, and the Senate only has constitutional authority to regulate commerce, and almost everybody in federal prison is there on a violation of interstate commerce charge, that it is a debt collection. All crimes are commercial, 27 CFR 72.11 tells you this. So we have to be very familiar with this word presentment. It goes on, it says, the grand jury must return indictments in open court, and the grand jury foreman must file a letter or certificate of concurrence with the clerk of court. That's Rule 6F, and I don't think they ever do that. But so a lot of times you're going to find with these indictments, the grand jury foreman didn't even sign it, or they'll have something stamped there in the place of the grand jury. Examine your indictment. Look at it very closely. The reason why they do this, because if they can get you to plea, hell, they ain't got to have nothing. You know, you ain't never seen no grand. You don't even know if the grand jury is composed of the Ku Klux Klan. And in the case of a white person, you don't know if the grand jury is composed of the Black Panther Party. You don't know. You know, it could be a whole group of people, kill all crackers or kill all niggas. You know, you don't know. And I'm like, no niggas. You know what I'm saying? You don't know. Well, the grand jury found you, probable cause to indict you. They be rubber stamping all of this stuff. You don't even get to participate. Now, let's go over the memorandum of law. Okay. We're going to go, this is on page 62, in support of this motion to dismiss these federal indictments. It says, the defendant's memorandum of law in support of notice to abate for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Number one, the only legitimate procedure for the government to get around proper process as prescribed in Rule 3 through 11 is if someone is joined to an existing investigation in accordance with Rule 8. In other words, there must first be an affidavit of complaint against someone as required in Rule 3. Then the process followed to Rule 5 and usually Rule 5.1 prior to a grand jury being selected and seated for the particular case. Thereafter, related offenses can be added and new defenses named in accordance with Rule 8. Then and only then does Rule 9 warrant apply. Defendant understands that at 28 U.S.C. 2072, federal rules of procedure may not deprive anyone of substantive rights. Poetically speaking, rights secured by the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 9th Amendments are carved in stone, and defendant further suggests they are cumulative. Rights are not independent or elective unless someone knowingly chooses to forfeit one of the specified rights. If one of the constitutionally secured rights is bypassed, administrative offices, including the Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney, and courts of the United States lack or lose subject matter jurisdiction. This is the essence of the Fifth Amendment, guaranteed that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Not only does there have to be law, which compels or prohibits any given activity, the law is usually complex, involving more than one statute, but procedure or process must conform to that prescribed by the Constitution and laws of the United States. The 4th, 5th, 6th, and 9th Amendments secure mandatory minimum requirements of due process. The 4th Amendment requirement for probable cause supported by oath of affirmation is the demarcation point. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath of affirmation. And they don't ever do that. How do they find the probable cause? Are you not even in the probable cause hearing? There must be, number one, oath or affirmation. Number three, a complaint that sets out the key elements of the crime. And number three, committing magistrate must issue a warrant based on the complaint. Unless or until these three threshold requirements are met, there can be no federal prosecution. Number seven, defendant, for illustration, will use federal tax law as an example at 18 U.S.C. subsection 3045. We find authorization for who may set the criminal prosecution process in motion via an affidavit or complaint. And here it is what it says. It says, warrants of arrest for violations of internal revenue laws may be issued by United States magistrates upon the complaint of a United States attorney, assistant United States attorney, collector or deputy collector of internal revenue or revenue agent or private citizen. But no such warrant of arrest shall be issued upon the complaint of a private citizen unless first approved in writing by a United States attorney. This code section needs an amount of qualification. Whoever makes the affidavit of complaint must have personal knowledge of the facts. All right, now that's what it is, too. Now, do these people have personal knowledge of the facts? They usually don't. In other words, the U.S. attorney cannot make the affidavit of complaint unless he has personally been involved with the investigation process and has hands-on involvement with securing and examining evidence. Defendant questions then if whether or not the federal rules of criminal procedure preserve this constitutionally secured right. We find that they do. Rule 3 of the federal rules of criminal procedure is specific. Rule 3, the complaint. The complaint is a written statement of the essential facts constituting the offense charge. It shall be made upon oath before a magistrate judge. Now, Rule 3 through 9 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure preserve the proper procedural sequence of the 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendments. If any portion of any of these rules, in other words, of any of these three elements, is defective, courts of the United States lose subject matter jurisdiction. Now, number 10, in our present environment, now we're going to go into an overview of what they do to you with the feds, okay? Now, in our present environment, the first most people know of a federal investigation is when they receive a summons in the mail with someone akin to an indictment attached, or they are arrested on a warrant with an indictment attached. Occasionally, a U.S. attorney, the Criminal Division of the Internal Revenue Service, the FBI, or another federal agency will notify the target of an investigation, and sometimes the target will be offered the opportunity to testify to a grand jury that may be considering an indictment. Defendant was never notified, and they don't ever do that. They don't notify anybody that there's a grand jury convened and about to indict you of something. And they're going to explain why they don't do this anymore. It says, whether arrested or summoned, the target's first court appearance is at the alleged arraignment after the grand jury has supposedly issued an indictment. At the hearing, the defendant is asked to enter a plea. If the defendant refuses to enter a plea, the presiding magistrate, usually a United States magistrate judge, enters a plea for him. After that ritual, the U.S. magistrate judge will either set or deny bond. Now, here's another thing. They always try to make you enter a plea. And then, you know, when you challenge things, you know, they still make you enter the plea. Now, here's the thing. Everybody needs to start challenging these grand juries. And these grand juries, if there is a really a grand jury, they need to know how to what their powers are. The grand jury can eliminate an indictment. The grand jury can strike down a law. And most of these idiots that are selecting as grand jurors don't know this. And because and the reason why is because they the grand jurors are in a lot of them are fronts. Like in some counties in Georgia, they were putting people on the grand jury and they were dead. You know, this is all, you know, you never get to see the grand jurors or anything like this. It's a dog and pony show, I'm telling y'all. Number 12. Where is the affidavit of complaint, probable cause, hearing, etc.? Has the defendant had the opportunity to examine witnesses and evidence against him, call his own witnesses, and present contravening documentary or other evidence? As we will see, current federal prosecution practice, for all practical purposes, trashes the 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendment and 9th due process rights and employs the services of quasi-judicial officers who do not have lawful authority to do what they are doing. And that's what they're all. They're quasi-judicial officers. These are not judicial officers because these are Article I courts. In sum, current federal prosecution practice, amounts to a criminal conspiracy among administrative and judicial officers. Federal criminal prosecution must begin with an affidavit of criminal complaint required by the Fourth Amendment and Rule 3 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Without the affidavit of complaint, courts of the United States do not have subject matter jurisdiction, so whatever ensuing verdict, judgment, and or sentence there might be is a nullity. It is void, and for that reason alone, this action should be vacated. Number 16, when we go to Rule 4, the probable cause hearing, warrants for seizure and or arrest must issue following a probable cause hearing. The federal courts are presently relying on Rule 9A, warrant or summons, upon indictment or information. Rule 9A, in relevant part, stipulates that upon the request of the attorney for the government, the court shall issue a warrant for each defendant named in an information supported by a showing of probable cause under oath as required by Rule 4A or in an indictment. More than one warrant or summons may issue for the same defendant. When a defendant is arrested with a warrant or given a summons appears initially before a magistrate judge, the magistrate judge shall proceed in accordance with the applicable divisions of Rule 5. Now, 18, the government then jumps to Rule 10, the arraignment, rather than dropping back to Rule 5. As Rule 9 specifies, Rule 5 is an initial appearance before a magistrate judge. Grand juries have certain investigative powers. If in the course of investigating a case that is lawfully before them, the grand jury members may find evidence sufficient to recommend additional charges or name additional defendants by way of presentment. But if the original complaint against the primary defendant for a specific offense is not before it, the grand jury has no basis for initiating any investigation. There must be original probable cause determined by a committing magistrate with the finding of probable cause before predicated by a complaint and affidavit. And they don't do any of this stuff. It's real, and even on the state level, they trash all of the procedures and so forth. Now, Rule 6B1, to demonstrate this, challenges. The attorney for the government or a defendant who has been held to answer in the district court may challenge the array of jurors on the ground that the grand jury was not selected, drawn, or summoned in accordance with law, and may challenge an individual juror on the ground that the juror is not legally qualified. Challenges shall be made before the administration of the oath to the jurors and shall be tried by the court. The right to challenge the grand jury array, its composition, and individual jurors is anteceded to individual jurors being administered the oath required prior to the grand jury being formally seated. All right, the government attorney and the defendant or the defendant's counsel both have the right to challenge the array and disqualify grand juror candidates prior to the grand jury being selected. It is this right that has been denied. There's a simple solution, and that is Rule 6B2, motion to dismiss. A motion to dismiss the indictment may be based on objections to the array or the lack of legal qualification of any individual juror, if not previously determined upon challenge. It should be made in the manner prescribed in 28 U.S.C. 1867E. Now, Rule 6C requires the grand jury foreman to record the vote, then file a letter or certificate of concurrence with the clerk. And y'all need to check that out because I don't think I've ever seen one of those. I've never seen a grand jury file a letter or certificate of concurrence with the clerk. And, you know, and I question the grand juries all the time because I've seen grand juries issue an indictment against a person. I'm like, this is ridiculous. Why would you indict this person? There is no evidence whatsoever to support this indictment. That's why here in Georgia, we got what's called indict or release. They will hold you in jail up to 90 days, all right, without indicting you. They'll just hold you in jail. All right. They can hold you up to 90 days. After 90 days, you have to file this, though, what's called an indict or release. If you don't file it, they'll hold you forever in jail without indicting you. So then I've been in jails before where there's been like 30 people in the cell with me. None of them been indicted. And they all come to my table and I issue indict or releases for them. And then within that same week, the grand jury came back with 30 indictments. And I had a question. I said, how did these grand juries go through all of these people's indictments this quick? I'm telling y'all, they're rubber stamped. This is why I'm doing this morning. You are the people out there. You are the composition of these grand juries. Y'all grand juries, y'all need to understand what the duties of a grand jury is. Like, you need to know what a nullification is. The grand jury can nullify. The grand jury can nullify any law. Let me tell y'all this. They really don't want, they want the public to remain ignorant of this. It's called jury nullification. Jury nullification. Jurors can say no. Grand jury discretion and constant, I'm going to put this up on my website, grand jury discretion and constitutional design. The grand jury possesses an unqualified power to decline to indict despite probable cause that alleged criminal conduct has occurred. A grand jury might exercise this power, for example, to disagree with the wisdom of a criminal law or its application to a particular defendant. A grand jury might also use this discretionary power to send a message of disapproval regarding biased or unwise prosecutorial decisions or inefficient allocation of law enforcement resources in the community. Now, this is y'all out there not exercising this power that you got. You let these people go in there. You don't even know who's on the grand jury. Who are these people issuing these ridiculous indictments against all of you? Find out who they are and see whether or not they understand this. Grand jury, and most of them are woefully ignorant. They've been on grand jury panel. I don't even know about grand jury nullification. Grand jury nullification, like its well-known cousin, petite jury nullification, is controversial. The dominant substantive critiques of grand jury nullification attack the grand jury's discretion in this regard as bad criminal justice policy at best and subversive of the rule of law at worst. Any acknowledgement of the grand jury's discretionary power often is accompanied by concerns regarding the damage that critics perceive it to levy upon the criminal process. This article, I'm gonna give this article and see what these people. This is what you got to understand, because the power is in the people. It's not in these fucking public servants. So they want to critique the grand jury nullification process, and they ain't got no fucking room. That's why I'm saying, this is why you have guns. This is why you have the Second Amendment. If we say there isn't an indictment, your public servants need to sit their ass down and shut the fuck up. That's just it. But you see, they try to get around y'all power. This is what you know, you've been usurped. It's a joke. I'm telling you. Let me get back. Y'all need to understand what's going on. All right. Let me get back to, I'm on page 66 of abatement at common law. We're talking about grand jury indictments right now. I'm giving you a document and I'm reading it for you. Talking about grand jury indictments. Now, number 24. If the original defendant or his counsel did not have the opportunity to challenge the grand jury array composition selection process, and individual grand jurors prior to the grand jury being seated, they're all disqualified, as the qualification process is among the defendant's constitutionally secured due process rights. So anytime you get indicted, when they show up at your door with an indictment, immediately you should move to have the indictment abated, because you didn't select these motherfuckers who decided to issue an indictment against you. Who are these people? Where are they getting them from? You don't even know who they are. You haven't even looked them in the eye. And originally, the grand jurors were supposed to be composed of people who knew who you were. How's somebody going to indict you and they don't know nothing about your character, what type of person you are, or anything like that? Nothing. Sending people to prison for life over this bullshit. These are devils. If you've been on a grand jury and you participated in this, and you know, you're a devil. You're ruining somebody's life. You don't know what the fuck you're doing. You just show up somewhere and just go along for the fucking ride. You need a burning goddamn hell. Let's get back. If a defendant doesn't know a grand jury is investigating him, he doesn't have an opportunity to challenge the grand jury array or individual grand jurors. Consequently, he's been deprived of substantive due process, which is expressly prohibited by 28 U.S.C. subsection 2072B. Now, we have an adversarial judicial system in this country, and that's what Obama just said. I just saw Obama say that on a thing. He said, we have an adversarial judicial system in this country. All parties to a given action, the government included, stand on equal ground. The system isn't set up for the convenience of the government. In fact, government always has the burden of proof, whether in civil or criminal matters. That's called the onus probandi. Is on he who asserts, not he who denies. Anybody who accuses you of something, they have the burden of proof, not you. They got to prove it. The onus probandi is on he who asserts, not he who denies. Burden of proof is on he who asserts, not he who denies. That's a maxim of law. The defendant has the right to challenge the qualifications and competency of everyone involved in the prosecutional process, inclusive of grand and pit jury selected from peers who ultimately have responsibility for determining indictable offenses and or final liability. If and when government personnel deprive the citizen of any of these rights, constitutionally secured due process of law is abridged and the courts lose subject matter jurisdiction. Not consider Rule 6F of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Finding and return of indictment. An indictment may be found only upon concurrence of 12 or more jurors. The indictment shall be returned by the grand jury to a federal magistrate judge in open court. If a complaint or information is pending against the defendant and 12 jurors do not concur in the finding of an indictment, the four persons shall so report to a federal magistrate judge in writing forthwith. The section of Rule 6 specifies foundational necessities. Federal government may prosecute felony crimes only on a valid affidavit of complaint that has been presented in a probable cause hearing, Rule 3 and 4. All right, so where is the probable cause hearing? Only corporations can be prosecuted via information. In the context of Rule 6F, we see the antecedent affidavit of complaint and probable cause hearing preserved in the second sentence. The grand jury may proceed only on complaint or information that has previously been formally processed. If the grand jury issues an indictment, the return must be made in open court to a magistrate judge. I don't even know if they do that. The return should appear on the case docket, and a transcript of the hearing should be available. A return of an indictment is the same as the petite. Now, I have asked them, like here in Georgia, we got a law where you can ask for a stenographic record of the grand jury proceedings. You can go, if you want to see what one of those motions look like, you can go get a Matthew Bender's forms and pleading book, and you can find it in there. But when you file it, they don't ever present it to you. How many of y'all have ever seen the transcript of the grand jury proceeding to show what was talked about in the grand jury before you got your indictment? You have a right to have that transcript, and they're not going to give it to you. Because it wasn't no fucking grand jury. I can tell you why you're not going to get it. Because they rubber stamping this shit. It's McDonald's. They got a goddamn assembly line. And we need to stop this shit. They have to do it like that because they got like 100,000 indictments pending and everything. They ain't got time to be running through all of this shit. Let's keep going. In practice, any given grand jury returns several indictments at once. However, when defendant understood the indictment process, it is clear that the grand jury pool may be held over for several months. But at any given grand jury is impaneled to consider only one charge or set of charges in related cases. And they don't do that. Like these grand juries, you know, like here in Georgia, they convene grand juries according to the terms of court. This is why it's important on your state level for you to understand what a term of court is. Because they convene different grand juries according to the term of court. And you need to know who these people are, especially in your county. You need to know who the grand jurors are, and you need to check those names. They used to attach the names of all the grand jurors to the indictments, and they stopped doing that because people wanted to check the names. Because having the name on there don't mean nothing either, because you don't know who this person is. You can't contact the person or nothing like that. They can make up names. This is why this is important. All right, this is in the Constitution. for you to understand that you have a right to voir dire the grand jury. Find out who these grand jurors are. And if you own the fucking grand jury, stop being a fucking ass kisser and a robot and have some grow a goddamn pair. Jury nullification. Everybody who listens to this show should know what that fucking word means. The return should be appear on the case docket, and a transcript of the hearing should be available. Now, if you don't know how to get your docket sheet, if you're in a federal case, you can go to Pacer. Go to Pacer.com, get you an account there, and you need to keep track of your case on Pacer. The docket sheet is going to be available on Pacer. The docket sheet keeps track of everything that is filed on your case. As a matter of fact, you got somebody sitting in jail. If you want to know when they got a court date coming up, go check the docket sheet. This is also where you're going to find where they do a lot of occult stuff too, especially if you're doing some of these processes. Because your court, on your docket sheet, it might show that your court date is one day, but they bring you into court another day. So you people on the outside need to know this shit. I'm giving y'all jewels. Because most of y'all family sitting out there on your ass, you don't know what the fuck is going on. Watch the docket sheet. Get on Pacer, pull up the damn case, get the docket sheet. Always keep up with your docket sheet. If you're sitting in jail, you should request that the clerk send a copy of your docket sheet every 2 weeks if you're in pretrial. It's how you keep up with your case. Stop calling your goddamn girl asking her, you know, well, can you go get somebody to go down there? Motherfucker, pick up a pen, write a goddamn letter to the goddamn district court clerk. And put a goddamn 45-cent stamp on it, and she'll send you your shit. And quit bothering your people, your family on the outside, and do some goddamn groundwork yourself. Let's keep going. In practice, to date, defendants haven't found where an indictment on any single case or set of related cases has been returned in open court and a transcript of the proceeding is available. I haven't seen it either. I don't know how many indictments I've looked at. I have yet to see them provide a stenographic record of a grand jury proceeding and a return in open court. Ask for it. Go find out in your state where it is required that they have a stenographic record. That means a transcript. What the fuck was said in the grand jury proceeding? What evidence did the prosecutor present that was so compelling that these idiots that they've companeled found it necessary to bring an indictment against you? Let's keep going. Rule 8 governs limit of the reach of any given grand jury. Rule 8 being joinder of offenses of defendants. During any court or jury session, any given juror might sit on one or more grand or petit juries, but each jury has limited subject matter jurisdiction. 38, where the grand jury is concerned, it may proceed only from an original complaint where probable cause has been found to issue additional indictments and or additional defendants where the crimes are the same or similar in character or are based on the same act or transaction or on two or more acts or transactions connected together or constituting parts of a common scheme or plan. That's Rule 8A, and Rule 8B specifies criteria for naming additional defendants. Here's where defendant's reservation of rights in Rule 9A comes in. When a defendant arrested with a warrant or given a summons appears initially before a magistrate judge, the magistrate judge shall proceed in accordance with the applicable subdivision of Rule 5. We will first consider Rule 5B and then the first portion of Rule 5C, misdemeanors and other petty offenses. If the charge against the defendant is a misdemeanor or other petty offense triable by a United States magistrate judge under 18 U.S.C. subsection 3401, the magistrate judge shall proceed in accordance with Rule 558. C, offenses not triable by the United States magistrate judge. If the charge against the defendant is not triable by the United States magistrate judge, the defendant shall not be called upon to plead. But they do that anyway. What is now known as the United States Master Judge was originally a National Park Commissioner. Do y'all know that? That the United States Master Judges were originally National Park Commissioners? The name of the office has changed, but the nature of the office hasn't. This is an administrative, not a judicial office. It is equivalent to that used by the police court magistrate. These are not judicial offices. Magistrate judges aren't. I asked a magistrate judge, a U.S. magistrate judge. I said, man, I need to be in front of Article III judge. You talking about, well, Julie Carnes is an Article III judge. That was the name of the judge down there in Atlanta. I think she's the chief judge. I think Julie then went to the appellate court division now. But she was the chief justice down there for the longest. It's a funny thing. I had a chief justice on my case on the federal level and a chief justice on my case on the state level. How lucky can you get on that? I don't know. That was something coming from the universe. But did y'all know that the United States Master Judges were originally National Park Commissioners or Commissioners? They do that in California. In California, you go to traffic court, you're not going in front of a judge. You're going in front of a commissioner. Okay, look, y'all. I got to break this now. We got 30 more minutes. What it is if you are in the chat room and you want to continue listening to this show, you're going to have to, call in, because up next, I started late today. Up next, we got Sister L coming on Prosperity Wednesday at 11 o'clock. Also, real quick, make sure that you go to my website and get on my email list. We're having a webinar this weekend, myself and Sharif. I'm sending out an email blast immediately after the show. You can get on my email list by going to highfrequencyradionetwork.com, clicking on email list, and I'll put you on the list, okay? So call in right now if you want to continue to keep listening to the show. Now, let's get back, because we're talking about these dumbass grand jurors or these ghosting grand jurors. You don't even know who the hell they are. They just indicting y'all ass. You ain't never met the motherfucker. Don't know shit about him. But he's just returning a grand. You just think that this shit is just how it's supposed to go. They just show up at your fucking house and put some handcuffs on you and cart your ass away and hold you in jail. And you can't ask no attorney. Don't even think about it. Go to an attorney and ask him to file a motion to dismiss an indictment and see what that motherfucker do. This is how you're going to find out whether they riding with you or not. This is why I'm showing y'all all this shit. We on some statutory time today. It ain't no common law or nothing. I'm just showing you how they don't even follow the rules in the statutory scheme of thing. They don't follow that. They don't follow that either. It says, today, the only offenses triable by a United States magistrate judge are traffic violation and other petty offenses committed on military reservations and national parks and forests, etc., under regulations promulgated by the Department of Defense and the Department of the Interior. United States magistrate judges and the several states have venue jurisdiction solely over offenses committed on federal enclaves where United States government has exclusive or concurrent jurisdiction ceded by one of the several states. As Rule 5C specifies, they cannot even ask for, much less make a plea for a defendant charged with a felony crime. This prohibition is effective under Rule 5, 9, 10, and 11, and they enter in a plea for you, and they can't even do it. That's a constitutional violation. They don't have jurisdiction to do that. When and if a United States magistrate judge asks for or makes a plea for a defendant in a felony case, he has usurped power vested in Article III judicial officer of the United States. Where this quasi-judicial officer exceeds his authority, Congress vested in him. Now notice, Congress invested authority in him. You're in a congressional court when you're in an Article I court. The kings of Article I court are your senators. That's why you write those motherfuckers a letter. Write the senators a letter. What the fuck is going on? What kind of fucking laws are y'all passing? Where y'all letting this shit go on? Get them old motherfuckers out of them offices. They're passing these ridiculous laws. I don't have nothing to do with you. Where this quasi-judicial officer exceeds authority Congress vested in him by law, the United States loses subject matter jurisdiction, and there are grounds to pursue lawful remedies, both civil and criminal. In other words, now you can do a Title 42 action against that magistrate for entering a plea for you. But you got to be able to document the fraud. You got to be able to document like dude is doing right here. Why is it that you could bring a case against him? You have to be able to document what is it that they did that violated your constitutional rights. If you could document it like this, now you got a leg to stand on. But you're just standing on and saying, I'm a Moor, and, you know, I declaim my nationality, and you don't have – you sound like a goddamn idiot. You have to be able to document in law how these people don't have jurisdiction over you. They're going to test you to see if you know why they don't have jurisdiction over you. You're in an adversarial proceeding, and they are not required to introduce exculpatory evidence in your favor. Exculpatory means evidence that can exonerate you. They don't have to do that. Somebody said, can you provide the lawful rule? It's called jury nullification. That's what it is. It's called jury nullification. Look the word up and go look it up in your law. It's called jury nullification. Why do you think we have grand juries? The law that gives them the ability to nullify it is the Constitution. That's what you find. It's constitutional. government officials, I'm on number 45 now. I mean, I'm reading out of Abatement of Common Law, page 70. I'm at number 45. Government officials, regardless of capacity, enjoy the cloak of immunity only to the outer reaches of their lawful authority. And that's why they'll say, well, we have immunity. They only have immunity if they act within the ambit of their delegated authority. As soon as they act outside that authority, they become personally liable. And how they become personally liable, if they violate any of these procedures, they are doing their own thing, and they become personally liable if they violate any type of process whatsoever. The notion of blanket judicial or any other absolute immunity is nothing more than a convenient fiction. And that's what it is. Ain't no such thing. They don't have no blanket immunity. And you tell them this, they'll know what you're saying. Now, Rule 5C, second paragraph, also specifies that a defendant is entitled to a preliminary examination unless waived when charged with any offense other than a petty offense, which is to be tried by a judge of the district court. Number 46, it is useful to understand the term magistrate judge as opposed to United States magistrate judge or United States magistrate judge. All right, the president of the United States is the nation's highest magistrate. And in other words, the magistrate is a ministerial, not a judicial office. Now, notice what I said, ministerial. I've told y'all what ministerial means. And when you're dealing with administrators, you need to know what a ministerial means. It does not comprise of any skill or anything or discretion. They are robots. They have to do what they're told to do. That's why you know you're not in front of a real judicial officer. Only Article 3 judges exercise that type of authority. Article 1 judges are robots. They have to do what the senators on Capitol Hill tell them to do. That's why you have these procedures and these statutes. These are being promulgated by the senators. They're telling the judges what to do in their courts. You're not in a judicial court. You're in a court that belongs to Congress. And they're telling everybody what to do. That's why they have sentencing guidelines. They're guiding the judges and telling them what to do. And that's a violation of separation of powers. If we're really in an Article 3 court, it is. But that's how you know you're not in an Article 3 court. Because an Article 3 judge will tell a goddamn senator, you take that shit and shove it up your ass. All lawful judges function in a magistrate capacity when they preside at probable cause hearings, initial appearances, and the like. In a sense, this is an extrajudicial capacity that within proper context can be vested in or exercised by administrative or judicial officers. The United States Magistrate Judge is an administrative office with quasi-judicial capacity limited to specific subject matter, where the district judge of the United States is vested with the full range of United States judicial authority. In other words, his extrajudicial capacity as magistrate judge extends to federal offenses of all stripes. Essentials of the preliminary hearing or examination are prescribed in Rule 5.1A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Probable cause finding. If from the evidence it appears that there is probable cause to believe that an offense has been committed and that the defendant committed it, the federal magistrate judge shall forthwith hold the defendant to answer in district court. The finding of probable cause may be based upon hearsay evidence in whole or in part. The defendant may cross-examine adverse witnesses and may introduce evidence. Now, that's what they use. They use hearsay evidence. And they also will use hearsay evidence against you if you're in a sentencing in federal court. A lot of y'all get mad and everything when y'all say, well, the prosecutor lied against me. It is not against the law to lie. It is against the law to commit perjury. Remember that. If they are not sworn in, they can say whatever they want to say because it is hearsay. If somebody says, well, you surveil, you know, he stole 12 cars. Objection, Your Honor, hearsay. If counsel wishes to testify, please have him take the stand and swear in under oath so he can subject himself to cross-examination. Your attorneys ain't going to do that. Watch what I'm telling you. Get in a federal case and see if your attorneys object to anything or do anything like that. And when you ask them to object to something, look at their face and watch how scared they're going to be, as if there's some vampire that's waiting for them after the commencement of the proceeding. They scared to death of federal courts. I don't know what's going on in there, but these attorneys, they are scared to death. They're terrified of prosecutors and them judges. I don't know what's going on in there, but they're terrified of it. And you're not going to get them to go against these people too tough. It's not happening. So anybody out there that thinks that what I'm saying is a bunch of crock on the air, roll with an attorney and see what happens. Go get you one. You don't have to listen to shit I'm saying. Go get you one. You'll be back. Now we go to Rule 5C, second paragraph. A defendant is entitled to a preliminary examination unless waived when charged with any offense other than a petty offense, which is to be tried by a judge at the district court. If the defendant waives preliminary examination, the magistrate judge shall forthwith hold the defendant to answer in the district court. If the defendant does not waive the preliminary examination, the magistrate judge shall schedule a preliminary examination. Such examination shall be held with a reasonable time, but in any event not later than 10 days following the initial appearance of the defendant in its custody and no later than 20 days if the defendant is not in custody, provided, however, that the preliminary examination shall not be held if the defendant is indicted or if an information against the defendant is filed in the district court before the date set for the preliminary examination. Now, most of y'all don't ever get this because y'all go hire an attorney and he waives it. Or in some areas, they'll say, well, you don't have to get you're not entitled to a preliminary hearing because you bonded out of jail. I never understood that. Why come I can't get a probable cause hearing? Because I bonded out. Is there something on that bond that requires that I don't have a preliminary hearing? Are you signing something that on that bond saying that you promised to pay when you bond out of jail? Think about this. If a defendant is joined to an indictment under Rule 8, he has the right to a preliminary hearing under Rule 5.1. This assures his opportunity to challenge witnesses and present evidence before him being subjected to the trial process. The right is particularly important where government prosecutions routinely play let's make a deal to secure incriminating testimony from questionable witnesses. And that's what they do. They're always trying to make a deal with you. But you got to stop all this in the preliminary action. Agree with your adversary before you get to court. You got to stop this machine before it gets started on you. It appears that the Department of Justice and United States attorneys are convening grand juries under auspices of the special grand jury provisions in Chapter 216, subsections 331 and 334 of Title 18. They're using special grand juries, which are private. However, this is a misapplication of law, as special grand jury investigation authority extends only to criminal activity involving government personnel, and the grand jury is limited to issuing reports. Defendants and prospective defendants are afforded the opportunity to rebut or correct the reports prior to public release. Although evidence unearthed by the special grand jury may be used as the basis of criminal prosecution, the special grand jury does not have indictment authority. it appears that the first steps towards securing secret indictments were taken during Prohibition days. Now, this is going to tell you where they started doing these special grand juries and why, in days of Al Capone and all of this. It appears, because this is what they're using against everybody, special grand juries. It appears that the first steps towards securing secret indictments were taken during Prohibition days to shield grand jury members from organized crime reprisal. Although secret indictments were and are presently unconstitutional, the extreme remedy in the midst of highly volatile and dangerous circumstances was rationalized in the midst of what amounted to domestic war with organized crime. Unfortunately, as other such rationalizations, those who found the extraordinary process convenient incorporated it into a routine practice. Now, I don't know. Are we still at war? Remember, is this why they're using these indictments the way they're doing? That's not following the constitutional process? Because that was for specific reasons when they were going against gangsters like Al Capone, and when people found out there was a grand jury being convened against them, they'd go and threaten the grand jurors to go kill them. But we're not in the days of Al Capone anymore. What is the rational basis for them continuing to use this process? Are we in a state of emergency or state of war? Are you an enemy of the state? Rule 60B of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure preserves causes to challenge judgments. They are as follows: mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. Newly discovered evidence, which may be by due diligence, could have been discovered in time to move for a new trial under Rule 559B. Fraud, whether heretofore denominated intrinsic or extrinsic, misrepresentation, or other misconduct of an adverse party. The judgment is void. The judgment has been satisfied, released, or discharged, or a prior judgment upon which it is based has been reversed or otherwise vacated, or it is no longer equitable that the judgment should have prospective application, or any other reason justifying relief from the operation of the judgment. Then the rule specifies the motion that shall be made within a reasonable time and for reasons 1, 2, and 3, not more than 1 year after judgment, order or proceeding was entered or taken. A motion under this subdivision B does not affect the finality of a judgment or suspend its operation. This rule does not limit the power of the court to entertain an independent action or relieve a party from a judgment, order, or proceeding, or to grant relief to a defendant not actually personally notified as provided in Title 28 U.S.C. subsection 1655, or to set aside a judgment for fraud upon the court. Writs of quorum nobis, bills in the nature of a bill of review, are abolished, and the procedure for obtaining any relief from a judgment shall be motion as prescribed in these rules or by independent action. And this is why I see people put in federal level, they put in quorum nobis or something in the nature of a quorum nobis. And it tells you right here, writs of quorum nobis have been abolished. I've seen dudes do this on a federal level. I mean, what do you put in a quorum nobis for? It's been abolished. You find a lot of stuff if you just read. It says there are two keys in Rule 60B. First rule, 60B4, where the judgment is void, opens the door to vacating the judgment at any time. Now, that's Rule 60B4, okay? If you are if you want to reopen something, Rule 60B4, let's read it. Rule 60B, relief from judgment or order, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Corrections based on clerical mistakes, oversights, and omissions, and B, grounds for relief from a final judgment, order, or proceeding. On motion and just terms, the court may relieve a party or its legal representative from a final judgment. Notice it says legal representative. Shouldn't you be signing your papers, authorized representative? How's the legal representative? Notice what it says right here. On motion and just terms, the court may relieve a party or its legal representative from a final judgment, order, or proceeding for the following reasons: mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect, newly discovered evidence. This is what, here it is, all right here. And then it has your timing and effect of the motion. Just read Rule 60. It says bills and writs are abolished. The following are abolished: bills of review, bills in the nature of bills of review, and writs of quorum nobis, quorum vobis, and audita querela. So read, all you have to do is read the stuff, y'all, and you'll see it. So let's go back. That's Rule 60B. A judgment is void where the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. The court lacks subject matter jurisdiction when and if the administrative agency has proceeded without statutory and regulatory authority, or the administrative agency has deprived the defendant of substantive due process rights, which is what every time that they come at your door with an indictment by some phantom grand jury, they have violated your due process rights. Where the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, the judgment is void, it has no lawful effect. The defendant may proceed by motion at any time without the encumbrance of time limitation, or may initiate collateral attack via extraordinary writs. In other words, an independent action. Respectfully submitted, use of veil. There, I went through, which are real quick, amend a random of law. Dealing with indictments and grand juries. Now, all this right here is everything for you. You should read this, and this is a study. All right, when you study this right here, it's going to increase your intelligence so much of the processes and everything that are going on with this. This is why I'm always talking about Abatement at Common Law by Don Quixote, okay? Because it's very, very intelligently written, and it will help you to understand the process of what you're going through, especially on the federal level. It has a section on here for abating traffic tickets, and it has a whole section on here for abating federal indictments. You can challenge subject matter jurisdiction at any time, and they have to give you a court date. But you need to follow the correct procedure for doing that. And with that, I'm going to take one phone call, because next we got coming up Prosperity Wednesday. Once again, remember, having a webinar this weekend. Check us out. Let me go to the phone lines real quick. Area code 202-4089. You're on high frequency radio. Washington, D.C.
Yusuf?
You're on the air.
Oh, good show. I'm sorry. I must have accidentally pushed the button. I wasn't prepared to ask the question. But great information, and I've already, downloaded and copied that Don Quixote document that you have, and I'll be, checking it out,
All right. Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Peace.
Okay.
All right. Let's go back to the phone line. Let's go to 469-6123. They must don't want me talking to y'all today, boy. I see. 469-6123.
Hey, what's going on? How you doing, brother?
Hey, what's happening, man? What's going on? How you doing?
I'm doing good, brother. I found it interesting when you was talking about these grand juries and how nobody knows who's on these grand juries.
Who they are? Nobody knows. Listen, man, and I'm in this, and I don't even know. I did some stuff. I'm like, who are these people? I done did some stuff, man, and I know that there ain't no grand jury looking at this stuff. I said, man, ain't no grand jury looked at this. There's too many people and everything. If they're looking at it, how are they looking at it? Half-ass looking at it? How can you go through that? I mean, one time I seen them, indict, 60 people, within 3 days. And I'm like, how do you got time to go through all the evidence to indict that many people that fast?
So, with that said, and you talk about, they have this 98% conviction rate. And my thing, and I keep going back in my mind, why do we keep their illusion up by participating with these assholes? Why do we keep contracting? See, it's all an illusion. The moment you stop doing it, it goes away. Okay, here's my example. Now, our women, they like to get their nails done. Okay, well, if you want these motherfuckers out your neighborhood, get young women, send them to school to be nail techs, and open up a business. Just and get the people to go to their business. Just like the brothers did on Black Friday down here in Lancaster. They redirected all the black people to go to the black beauty supply house instead of using the Korean. What happens? Eventually, they go away. They're no longer
exactly.
in the neighborhood.
Exactly.
So we keep empowering our own oppressors because we keep fucking with them. But then we mad because they treat us the way that they do, but you keep going to their fucking store. That's all, man. I mean, good show, man. You had a great show today, brother.
Hey, man, appreciate it. I'm saying, who's this calling me? Somebody calling me. I'm like, middle of a damn show and everything. I'm like, damn, you don't know I'm on the air? But anyway, apologize. Sorry about that. But, man, you're absolutely correct, man. You know, the thing is, we got to start participating. But I wanted people to be aware of this grand jury. I thought it was very, very key because you got a lot of people that are going out there. I don't even know if somebody's been on a grand jury or not. A lot of times what they'll do, if a case is very high profile, that's the only time you'll see them follow all the procedures because they got to because there's so many eyes on them. But overwhelming majority of all of these cases, ain't nobody watching these cases, man. Who are these people indicting all these people? That's why I'm trying to tell people, the grand jury, when you first study the Constitution, it's supposed to be of your peers. How can somebody indict me who's never met me before, don't know anything about
me? Right. Yusuf, you got to understand, they've been doing this shit for so long, and the people have been ignorant for so long, now it's on cruise control. It just runs itself now.
It just runs itself. And also, what's going to happen is, the reason I'm bringing this up, when you start understanding the grand jury process, that's another way you're going to find out you're not going in a real court. That's another way you're going to find out. See, I'm giving y'all information so y'all can start to look at these people and see why they're putting on a dog and pony show, why it's a stage play. Because the Constitution mandates certain things that they're supposed to do, and they're not doing it. But they're trying to give everybody the impression that they are. But until you start really scrutinizing it and examining it, you're never going to know. They are operating solely off the basis they believe that the American people are stupid and illiterate. I'm trying to tell you.
Yep.
I'm trying to tell you. People get mad at me for talking like that, but their whole thing is they are 100% perfectly comfortable because nobody reads anything. You do not read nothing. All right, and that's why I went through this. I just went through that entire memorandum of law for y'all this morning, okay? So there isn't any excuse. And with that, man, I'm out of time. Only got about 3 minutes left. Sister L is coming on next. So,
all right, peace, brother.
Hey, peace, man. I appreciate it.
All right, now.
Coming up next, y'all, is Sister L. I apologize for not getting on early this morning, but I thought I would at least bless y'all with that information this morning. Y'all can go into the archives and review that. And start understanding what your rights are. Know what jury nullification is. Understand what a voir dire of a grand jury means. Know what your rights are. Stop letting these people just rubber stamp everything and play McDonald's and Burger King with us. Like they're going through a drive-thru. This is drive-thru justice that they exacting on all of us. And that has to be put to a stop. I want to thank everybody for tuning in this morning to High Frequency Radio. Up next, you got Sister L coming on. Keep it locked right here. Hottest radio network on the planet, High Frequency Radio. Y'all, peace.
Never see him get done. What you know about all day?